All right, buddy. Let me see what I can do here with this. The Night Shift, starring Scott Sherman.
What's he like, our boss or what?
No, he's the supervisor. He's not here at night.
Nah, get out of town. Just you and me and the stiffs alone here? That's going to be radical. That guy's dead.
Are you sure this is legal?
I don't know. It's fun, though, isn't it?
Idea to eliminate garbage. Edible paper.
That's a remarkably idiotic thing that you just said.
In stupid sense. You know what I'm saying?
Huh? Tuna fish.
Hold it. Wait a minute. Take live tuna fish and feed them mayonnaise.
This is good. Call Starkist.
The Night Shift. The current affairs show for everyone.
We'll be fighting in the streets with our children at our feet. In the morrows that they worship, we'll be gone.
Starring Scott Sherman. On the Night Shift. Here's your host, Scott Sherman.
Welcome in, everybody. Happy Friday to you. You made it if you work during the day. Happy weekend. And if not, we'll suffer along with you. 9 to midnight on Big 550 KTRS in St. Louis and streaming everywhere at KTRS.com. My name is Scott Sherman. This program, The Night Shift, is what we call the current affairs show for everyone. We take the world and we try to make it a more interesting, enjoyable, and hopefully more understandable place. We do that Monday through Friday, 9 to midnight. Helping me do that every night is my engineer and producer, Mr. Kyle Bittner.
Hello, Mr. Sherman.
How are you, sir?
I am perplexed.
Why?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Stir fry. How do you make good stir fry at your house? You go to like a Japanese steakhouse or something, and
can't
they make
it,
and it looks easy. I chopped up the vegetables. I get the wok out. I throw some soy sauce. I don't know.
The heat is not high enough in the average home kitchen. Do you have an electric stove?
No,
or do you have gas stove?
I have a gas stove turned
crank
up.
It.
It's pretty hot.
It's not hot enough. They fire that wok in most of these places at 1,200,000 degrees. It's so hot, it's hotter than the sun. If you can't scorch your peas, you don't have your wok hot enough. And at least that's what I think. Plus, you probably don't have the right wok. Do you have a ham-hammered, like stainless or a cast iron wok? Or you got one of those cheap, flimsy aluminum woks?
Well, you know who you're talking to.
You have a cheap, flimsy aluminum paper wok. You can't make Chinese food in a paper wok.
It's Emeril Lagasse, I think. I don't know. But seriously, I think it's a sauce thing, too. I tried just regular soy sauce. I think you need to... I'm thinking there's some other thing. I don't know. It was edible.
Industry chef people, welcome. Text at 84126. You can call us if you're hands-free on the line, as they say, in the food industry. At 314-969-5877 and 888-550-5877. And happy Pi Day,
oh,
sir.
Yeah.
Yes. A big slice of 3.1416171819 and 110. How far can you do pi?
I think you can go a long ways.
You can't make a circle without pi. And you can't have a birthday party without cake. This is what I'm saying. So if somebody, they've been bringing us cake, Kyle. It's time to bring us pie.
Bring it by
the studio.
Yeah, they can.
Don't put any meat
cake in
it because it's Lent. Oh, by the way, we're looking for the best fish fry between now and the end of Lent. St. Louisans, bring us free fish. I'm starving.
And we'll plug you for free.
Yeah,
and
we'll have a little contest. And if we really think you're the best, we'll give you a trophy at the end of this as well.
And if I know anything about Scott, he'll just say they're all the best, and you guys will all tie.
You'll all tie.
That being awesome.
Free food is always welcome. Got a great show. We'll start from the back to the front. Mighty Max, hour three, will give us his preview of the Final Four. It's the big dance, folks, and I knew nothing about college basketball before he sort of gave us a little primer last week. Now it's conference tournament time. I still know virtually nothing. I'm in the second grade when it comes to college basketball. And however, Mighty Max will give us previews of some of the best teams, maybe a little bracketology, all the folks that like to follow that, and who doesn't have a NCAA college basketball bracket in their office. Mighty Max, our 13-year-old sports prognosticator and analyst in hour number three. Hour number two, Steve Light will be here. He's our resident guru on investing. He's the co-host of Retire Worry Free with Steve and Greg. He's the Steve of that. It's good thing he is the Steve. He'll be around in hour number two. Schwilly, you know, he hasn't exactly checked in, but our pal in Vegas, Schwilly, will be here. I have faith in hour number two. And when we're done with this little segment, our pal Morris Turek from It's mytrademarkattorney.com. I keep calling it yourtrademarkattorney.com, and he's yelling at me. Is it mytrademarkattorney.com?
It is yourtrademarkattorney.com.
I can get it wrong. Yourtrademarkattorney.com. He'll be here for an hour. I'll get it right by then. I had to get Professor Cheese right. It took me an hour. And then she was off. So Morris Turek will have some IP stuff. Schlafly will be fighting for its trademark. And then speaking of, there's Steve and Greg. There's also Sam and Dave, a lawsuit involving the great soul music group from the 1960s and 70s. But we have an answer to the walk stuff?
No, we have JT calling in with all things fish fry that you need to know.
Buddy. JT, welcome to the night shift.
Well, I do know a little bit about woks. I have one of those handmade ones that you were talking about that are really, really nice.
Excellent.
As far as fish fries, I have a preference for two of them. Our Lady of Pillar over on Lindbergh, just north of 40.
Okay.
And Holy Spirit out in Maryland Heights.
Oh, that's right by us. And, in fact, the Our Lady of Pillar, is that right across from West County Mall? Am I right or wrong?
Just south of Old St. Charles Rock Road and just west of McKelvey.
Okay.
And what makes these heads and shoulders above the rest?
JT, why are these so great?
Well, with Holy Spirit, they've got my favorite baked cod recipe.
Ooh, I like that.
I try to make a point of getting there at least twice a year for the baked cod, and more than once I've gotten there too late and they've sold out.
JT, what time's the best time to get to Holy Spirit for the baked cod?
As soon as they open.
As soon as they open. I love it.
Is that a time?
Now, I do have a special request having to do with fish fries.
Yes, sir. Yes,
sir. My son has been in the last year diagnosed with celiac disease, which means he cannot eat anything with wheat.
Okay.
So if anyone in St. Louis knows of a gluten-free fish fry or a fish fry that has gluten-free options.
All right. We will definitely.
I would love to hear.
That would be fantastic. And our friend Elizabeth Imus is gluten-free. You hear her Thursday. So we'll put that out. Everybody out there listening, we need a gluten-free fish fry for JT's son. What's your son's name, JT?
Brandon.
Brandon? All the best to Brandon. All the best.
Thank you.
All right, my friend, thanks for the heads up. One more question, JT, the walk. Tell Kyle what the key to getting, besides having the right walk, the key to making the Asian food taste right?
It's a combination of ingredients. Sesame oils, Asian fish sauce, Thai chili paste, seasonings that are uniquely oriental in nature, but are available here in America. And by the way, a lot of these items that are, quote, oriental in nature, were developed by Oriental immigrants here in America, taking what they had available here and bringing their ancestry to the table.
Outstanding. Well done. And what about a hot wok? Can't go wrong.
To do it properly, yes, you got to get the wok really hot, and you need a good gas stove. The electric stoves just can't put out enough heat, and those magnetic inductions also just can't generate enough concentrated heat. You need a really good stove with a really hot burner, and that that ring that holds the wok just above the flame.
JT, solid. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Have a good night. Look at there. Two great contenders for the fish fry. You didn't notice he didn't offer to bring us any fish.
I did notice that.
Yeah, but you know
he
what?
Also didn't tell us what time they opened. He just said, get there when they open. Well, that's very vague.
At 4 p.m.
We'll just get there at noon and hang
just
out.
You should just sleep outside. It's it's like a fish concert. You should just sleep outside. Krzyzewskiville, when you go to, speaking of basketball, with Cameron Indoor, sleep out the night before.
They do that?
At Holy Spirit? You bet your butt they do.
No, I mean at...
At the Cameron Indoor? Yeah, there's a certain amount of tickets, because it's a real small place, that the students, I don't think that they can get. So they sort of tent city it for a while. But they go to Duke, so, you know, they have rich parents.
I don't like basketball that
much.
They
have rich parents. They don't have to go to class.
Okay.
Or they're in porn. It's one of the two.
Ooh. Well,
oh,
I guess you can't
I'm
be
sorry.
Too
did
soon
I take,
on that one.
did I take an unfair swing at the freshman adult film actress that goes to Duke? Gluten-free is very important, especially for folks like Brandon, young man. We wish him all the best, and thanks to JT for the call. Kyle, I think we got somebody else ready with a tip for you on the cooking.
No, that was JT. 4:30 and 4 is when they
opened. 4:30 and 4. Thank you, JT.
Thank you very much.
We got so much to do, and our pal Morris Turk's over there studying. He's mad at me. It's I'm going to let him say it.
Trademarkattorney.com.
He's our trademark attorney. It's your trademarkattorney.com.
Tough.
All right. You know what? We're going to cut this segment short so we can put him under the gun. We're going to talk about Schlafly Beer and their trademark. We're going to talk about Sam and Dave, the great performers from the Incredible Stax record label, lawsuit involving a movie a few years back, all things intellectual property. I find this stuff fascinating. And you will too. Morris will be plugging his own website when we get back. Oh, yeah, and it's St. Patrick's Day Monday, my favorite holiday of the year. So we'll play some Irish music too. Van Morrison, he's from Ireland. He's our OurIrishSinger.com. More night shift. Morris, don't leave, please. Right after this.
Yeah, that song made to my soul.
Now back to the night shift.
One, two, three.
With your host, Scott Sherman.
A long time ago, way back in history, when all there was to drink was nothing but cups of tea, along came a man by the name of Charlie Mott. And he invented a wonderful drink and he made it out of hop.
Oh, yes. You get two cracks at this one, me Irish lads and lassies. Tomorrow, the family, I put that in air quotes, parade. And then the real, I put that in all bold and italics and double bold wide. That would be the Dogtown Parade Monday on the real St. Pat's. And that would be the 17th.
Yeah, I'm not going to be here Monday night.
I don't know that either one of us is going to be anywhere good Monday night. That's Flogging Molly. And the gentleman they're speaking about in their song, Beer, 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 is, of course, the fictitious, sorry to the linguistic people out there, Charlie Mops. Took me six times to figure out that name. Back to the night shift.
Did he chase all the snakes out?
What?
Did he chase all the snakes out, or what is he?
Oh, no, that's St. Patrick. He chased all the snakes. YourTrademarkAttorney.com. Thank you very much. He's our pal Morris Turek. He's an intellectual property lawyer, not only in this town, but just about everywhere that people will hire him. He's very smart. He's very well schooled in these things. And most importantly, he's entertaining. Welcome back to the night shift, Morris Turek.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
Well, we appreciate it very much, and we only did this because we wanted to meet the lovely Karen, your significant girlfriend who is here. Hi, Karen. She's not talking.
Don't be shy, Karen.
Well, we didn't want to interrupt date night, Morris, but you were kind enough, both of you, to come in on short notice, even though we thought about it long and hard. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Did we interrupt anything?
just the night in eating Taco Bell. No big deal.
I love it. You know, this, that's the couples that last, the ones that have the low-maintenance relationship. That's how it
That's right.
All right, we'll talk more about that when Karen's not here. We'll talk about you with Karen when you're not here. We'll find out the real Moore story. All right, my friend.
Wonderful.
St. Louis is well known for beer. Beer. It's a beer baron town. Of course, AB, whatever they're calling it now, Anheuser-Busch founded here. Not the only one. There was the Lemp family. They made Falstaff and some other stuff that I don't think they make anymore. They do. It's hard to find. And most recently, craft beers. And one that's becoming a larger player is Schlafly Beer.
That's right.
But now they're getting so big that they got a little bit of an issue. Before we get into the issue, let's talk a little bit about your specialty, which is intellectual property law, and the importance of the Schlafly brand and a thing we call trademark.
Well, right. So obviously Schlafly's been around, I think, since the early 90s, and they've been using the name Schlafly since that time to designate the source of their beer. That's what they call their beer. Recently, they've been attempting to register the word Schlafly federally with the United States Patent and Trademark Office, and they've had some problems.
Now, are there Schlaflys that run this place, or does Schlafly mean anything? Is it a process, or is it people? I know nothing about it other than they got a place down on Oliver in 15th or something.
Yeah, it's my understanding that there is no English language meaning to the word Schlafly other than as a last name. And I believe it was founded by a guy named Tom Schlafly,
he named it after himself.
After his family name. Yeah.
And so when he has a family name, you would think the guy would have the right to name the thing after himself, but not necessarily, right?
Here's the interesting thing. So if you look in the trademark office's records, you'll see that the Schlafly Company actually owns two federal trademark registrations dating back a number of years that are for marks that incorporate the word Schlafly. There are actually two of them. One is a logo that has the words Schlafly since 1991. And then there's another one, which is that circular logo you see on all the beer bottles that has Schlafly across sort of the center of the circle and then Brewed in St. Louis around the edge. They have registration for that as well.
So they've got distinct marks, trademark marks, things they use in business, and they've been in business for over 20 years now.
They have.
And nobody made a stink about it when they were just making stuff in St. Louis and sort of distributing it in the Midwest.
It seems that way. These registrations date back a number of years, and these registrations are what we call incontestable because they're over 5 years old.
So what is the 5-year plea? It's like a statute of limitations. You got to speak up or forever hold your peace.
So after a registration is 5 years old, it can only be challenged on very narrow grounds. Most of the time, these incontestable registrations are not challenged.
Okay. Well, Morris, then there's this woman named Phyllis Schlafly, who I have heard about, and she was sort of in the political sphere. She's basically known for this thing called the Eagle Forum. Goes back, I think, to the early 70s. She doesn't like women doing non-traditional things, and she's very conservative. I don't want to besmirch her character because she can do that herself, and she does that very well. So whatever her politics are, she's nuts. But she's been sort of the grandmother of the social conservatism movement. And when I first heard about Schlafly beer when I moved here, I thought, geez, that Phyllis Schlafly, she might be – conservative in the kitchen, but she makes a mean pilsner. Maybe she's a little more fun than I thought. Not the same people.
Doesn't seem that way.
So Phyllis Schlafly now, I don't know where she's been for the last 20 years.
I have no idea.
Under a rock somewhere, but now she's been awakened. Somebody said, hey, Phyllis, she's got to be 90. They're trying to sell Schlafly beer. You have to put a stop to this. And so is the Phyllis Schlafly or is Phyllis Schlafly's friends? Who's upset with the Schlafly Brewing Company of St. Louis?
It's kind of hard to say. I mean, when I looked at the trademark office's records and I've read some news stories about it as well, what happened is that the Schlafly Company has applied to register just the word Schlafly. And it appears that Phyllis Schlafly has filed an opposition against the registration of the mark, claiming that Schlafly is merely a surname and not registrable federally with the trademark office. So surnames by themselves are not federally registrable. So if somebody wanted to register, you know, Sherman Radio Production.
It's a little sarcastic, wasn't he?
That probably would not be registered because that's merely a surname. Sherman's a, you know, a well.
What about
surname.
Bush? Now, Bush, Anheuser-Busch, then that's a last name, but Bush is a trademarked mark.
It is.
For Anheuser-Busch's cheapo beer.
It is, and there are plenty of other surnames that are registered that we all know. Ford, Dell, McDonald's. These are all surnames. What Phyllis Schlafly is saying is that the name Schlafly has not acquired distinctiveness. It hasn't become well known enough to warrant federal registration, unlike Ford or Dell or McDonald's or something like that.
So, Morris, what's the standard? Does it have to be ubiquitous, or is there a legal standard that a judge would look at to say, okay, Schlafly, maybe in St. Louis and, you know, sort of up to Chicago or out to Kansas City, you're a big deal, but nobody in Hartford, Connecticut knows who you are? Or is it more where it's like, hey, Phyllis, we thought you were dead. I mean, you know, what are you talking about? Of course I know this beer. I'm a craft beer fan. So what does a judge look at to determine this?
Yeah, I mean, it's very subjective, but obviously they're going to look at sales. What are your revenues? What are your sales? Where do you advertise? You know, how many barrels of beer did you sell? All those kinds of things to determine whether, you know, this name Schlafly is exclusively associated with the Schlafly Beer Company. And I think, you know, in this case, Phyllis Schlafly doesn't have a case. The very fact that Schlafly already owns two federal registrations that incorporate the word Schlafly in it, and they're incontestable registrations. The very fact that the beer has been sold under that name for over 20 years, there's just no way that Phyllis Schlafly is going to win this case.
That's good news on a variety of fronts, but mainly for a small business, because to lay in the weeds like this, you would think if she had any objection, it would have been early on.
Absolutely.
where I thought, hey, that Phyllis Schlafly makes a mean beer. And she would have said, well, I don't drink, or I'm opposed to a brewery. You shouldn't be able to use the name Schlafly because of confusion. This doesn't have anything to do with confusion. What is the standard to say, sorry, Johnson & Johnson, I'm a Johnson, and I don't like your Q-tips? I mean, what is the standard for this?
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, Phyllis Schlafly isn't claiming that the name Schlafly uniquely identifies her, and therefore the Schlafly company would need her consent to register the mark. She's not even claiming that. She's just claiming Schlafly is a surname, it has an acquired distinctiveness, and you can't register it. I'm not really sure what her motivation is to attempt to stop the registration of the Schlafly mark. That is not clear from any of the news stories I read or the opposition papers.
She's lucky they didn't name the beer Right Wing Lunatic, or she might have a case. All right,
very possible.
All right, Morris.
Is it possible to Morris get a payout in something like that in beer, like a lifetime supply of beer? With that,
hey, you never know what they could settle for, I guess.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, Morris Turek is our trademark attorney. You want to hire him, talk to him, or have a question for him, go to yourtrademarkattorney.com, yourtrademarkattorney.com, and I get that right because he can bench press 800 pounds and kick my butt right in front of his girlfriend.
But I won't.
Kick sand in my face. You won't. All right.
I won't.
We're going to stick around when we come back. Are you a fan of soul music, sir?
Not really.
Okay.
Sorry.
What a lead in. All right. Stax Records, the legendary place where Otis Redding got his start. Sam and Dave got their start. So many other great musicians got their start. Isaac Hayes did a lot of work there. We'll talk about that case involving Sam and Dave and a movie that was made that sort of parodied their lives when The Night Shift returns right after this.
But it's all so you gotta do is try. You gotta do is try.
This is The Night Shift, starring Scott Sherman.
This show has never sounded better than it just did right now. Play this a little bit, buddy. Take it to the beat. The legendary Sam and Dave, part of the incredible stable of musicians in the 1960s and 70s from Stax Records out of Memphis, Tennessee. I saw a documentary recently about him. I stayed up all night watching it. It was that cool. Of course, I stay up all night every night. Otis Redding. I mean, who doesn't love the Staples Singers? Incredible musicians. And unfortunately, they went out of business in the 1970s, but made a resurgence recently. Booker T and the MGs. I mean, you know, so many great things. Back on the Night Shift. And we're talking with our pal, Morris Turek, yourtrademarkattorney.com. There was a lawsuit, Morris, and we'll get to it in a second. But Karen,
yes.
Did you like that song?
I did like that song.
Yeah, I got you on the microphone.
All righty.
So do you do like sort of soul music? And
yes, I do.
Because Morris said he didn't like it.
Morris doesn't know what he's talking about.
There we go. That's the right answer.
I'm more of a 90s grunge guy.
Oh, well, you kind of have a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about this because there was a movie that had Samuel L. Jackson and Bernie Mac, the late, great Bernie Mac, in it called Soul Men. And the plot of it was that these guys were part of a trio. John Legend was the other musician in it. The John Legend character dies, and these two guys sort of go on the road to resurrect this trio as a duo. They're not called Sam and Dave. They do sing a Sam and Dave song. But Sam Moore of Sam and Dave felt, hey, you're ripping me off. Nobody asked me my permission. Nobody paid me anything. I'm going to sue you. What happened in this case?
Well, the court, I guess basically the court looked at the, looked at the movie and looked at Moore's claims. And the court decided that there was no likelihood of consumer confusion. Nobody would believe that Moore sponsored or endorsed or was affiliated with the movie.
And so what's the importance of that? Because this sounds like, to me, the Sam Moore claim is one of these right of publicity kinds of that Johnny Carson, Tony Twist kind of things. Hey, I'm famous. Hey, I got a face and a name and a voice and movements, and you ripped me off. And you didn't pay me. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say. I think one thing that the case or the court noted was that Moore's name and really his likeness didn't really appear in the film, which is I think a little bit different than the Tony Twist case we were talking about a few weeks ago, where this was like clearly a ripoff of Tony Twist's persona as a hockey player enforcer type character.
Yeah, it's just that, I mean, you got two soul singers. Not every two soul singers are Sam and Dave, especially when their names aren't Sam and Dave in the movie. They were the something trio, but they weren't Sam and Dave. They did sing "Hold On, I'm Coming" as a cover song, but again, soul singers in the 1960s or people that got famous in the 60s, what are they going to sing? I mean, you go out, you're going to sing Soul Man, you're going to sing Sam and Dave, but you can be your own group without ripping somebody off. So, So Morris, what are some of the considerations when somebody's making a movie or writing a screenplay and they're going to incorporate based on certain real life characters so that they don't get into this right of publicity problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with, how, and I'm going to use sort of the court's language, how transformative the movie or the creative work is. So, if there's more to the creative work than just the likeness or the identity of the would-be plaintiff of the famous person, then that's going to lead a court to say, okay, that's more of a First Amendment protected expression than just using somebody's likeness for commercial gain. And so like a two-hour movie that isn't just based on somebody's likeness is going to get that First Amendment protection.
And they call it the creative components defense, mm-hmm. which I think I'm going to change that to the Velvet Elvis defense. Because there was a relatively famous Tiger Woods painting that a guy painted of Tiger Woods, you know, probably one of these horrible things that says mission or there's an eagle on it and then there's a picture of Tiger Woods. And Tiger Woods was like, I hate that painting. You ripped me off. It's just a painting of me. But the court in that case said, no, it was creative enough and there were enough creative components to change it in some way, right?
Right. And that transformative test, I don't think that's applied in every state, though. Like you said, it was applied in that Tiger Woods case and it was applied in the in this Soulmen case as well. So I think it does depend on what jurisdiction you happen to be suing in. Because right of publicity law, it's not federal. It's all state by state.
That's interesting. And good news for all velvet painting aficionados. So you can still go to a gas station somewhere in L.A. and get a Velvet Elvis without it violating the right of publicity of the late Elvis Presley's estate.
I'll take your word for it.
All right. So talk about the First Amendment stuff, because this is important. There's like sort of the law always seems to have a balancing or a tug of war.
Yeah.
But there's really a tug of war here between people's genuine and very important right to have intellectual property, which is sometimes something that you would defend for a client. And then the other tug is for the First Amendment, for free expression and free speech, which I'm sure you're also have been on the other end of that argument as well. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to the audience a little bit about that dynamic, why both of them are important, and what a court does to figure out in a case-by-case basis which one should win?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a matter of fairness, right? I mean, obviously, people who are celebrities, famous people, they have an interest in their – and a legitimate interest in their – in their identity and their likeness, and they, understandably want to control that. On the flip side is the First Amendment, you know, people's ability to talk about famous people, use famous people in stories. For instance, you know, if somebody wanted to create a documentary about the Beatles, let's say, I mean, clearly the Beatles or their, you know, or their estates, you know, once they all pass away, I mean, they're not going to be able to stop somebody from making a documentary about the Beatles. That would be against the First Amendment. So clearly we know that people can make movies, write books, do plays about famous people. The question, I think, is, you know, when it's not being used to educate or necessarily fully just to entertain, but you're also using it to it's more of a commercial exploitation of the person rather than trying to educate or, like a documentary would.
You know, you mentioned the Beatles, and there was mm-hmm. back in the 1970s and early 80s, there was this, I guess they were a touring group, and it was a play, and it was Broadway, it was called Beatlemania. And it was really sort of a dramatic interpretation of the relationship of the Beatles. And then they would perform as the Beatles. Mm-hmm. Currently, they weren't the Beatles because the Beatles weren't playing. And everybody knows what John Lennon and Paul McCartney look like. So is it – how far can you take sort of your interpretation or your First Amendment right to expression before you step on that landmine in things with intellectual property rights blow up?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I think it's very subjective. Obviously, what one person might think crosses the line, another might not. And also, I do think it depends on where you happen to be at the time, whether you get sued in California or sued in New York or sued in Missouri. Those laws are going to be different.
So if somebody came to you, a producer or a director or somebody was writing, and they said, look, Morris, I think I want to write sort of a dramatic interpretation or dramatic play about the Beatles. I want to talk about the last days of the Beatles. I want to sort of portray them as arguing, and I want to play some Beatles songs and have some sort of, I guess people imitate John, Paul, George, and Ringo. What would be your warnings to them, and what could they do as far as playing the music in that movie or in that play versus just having a dramatic, a screenplay or just a movie about it?
Yeah, well, certainly with the music, that's an easy question. You need a license, obviously, to use Beatles music in a documentary or a movie or, any kind of dramatic play or anything about the Beatles. You're going to need a license. But with the, with the movie, there is absolutely nothing stopping somebody from from producing a movie about the Beatles. And like you said, sort of like if you want to talk about how the Beatles maybe were fighting in the last days of the group's existence, certainly. There's nothing stopping you from doing
that. So you can make a documentary about the Beatles, but it's going to suck because you're not going to have any clips, not going to have any music. And unless you get the interviews yourself, you're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I mean, there is some compulsory licensing for the movies and stuff for music and things like that. But you oftentimes when you see a movie about a real life person, you'll see sometimes that it says it's authorized, or sometimes it'll say it's unauthorized. So you know, and you'll see like you know with books, this is the authorized biography instead of an unauthorized biography.
So the folks that made the Soul Man movie with the late Bernie Mac. That movie won, and Sam Moore lost. So
that is correct.
Good news for the First Amendment. Why don't we do this? Let's take a break. More with our IP expert, Morris Turek, attorney at law. Go to yourtrademarkattorney.com for questions or consultations with our pal Morris. Play this one. This is unbelievable. Take a break. More Night Shift after this.
Arms of mine, they are lonely.
I can't get through lonely with Sam and Dave without playing the great Otis Redding, also from Stax Records. Tragically killed in a plane crash. Way too young. Back on the Night Shift. All right, Morris Turek, your trademarkattorney.com. We have this story about piracy, I put it in parentheses, of downloading movies, and those people that own the rights to those films trying to get the pirates are, it's getting a little tougher, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, definitely. A lot of these courts are putting the kibosh on these copyright holders from suing, you know, hundreds or thousands of defendants in one lawsuit.
This thing called BitTorrent, and they've had these others. Kim.com had the other one. Explain a little bit to the audience, because Jose's talked about it, our tech guy, about how people can sort of download movies that are first-run movies without paying for them.
Yeah, well, I'm not a techie, so I don't know exactly how BitTorrent works, but it's my understanding that essentially you have people who are putting out the movies in, you know, obviously in digital format, and people who I guess those are the seeders, and then the people who want the movies are taking little bits and pieces from the movie from all the different people that are seeding the movie. And so it's a very quick and efficient way of downloading larger files. And so when all is said and done, after they're done taking all the bits and pieces from the movies, they have a full movie on their computer.
All right, I thought you weren't a tech guy. Seeding. Listen to you. You're sandbagging us,
Kyle. I don't
do
it, though.
Sandbagging us. Of course not. But you have defended these people before. But it's interesting because the copyright holders and the legitimate copyright holders sue thousands of people at one time, and they supposedly can, I got you because I got your IP address.
Well, yeah.
It's not so simple.
Not quite. So what happens is these copyright holders, they can see on the internet who is downloading illegal movies using different kinds of software and whatnot. Then they file a lawsuit against, you know, 1,000 defendants saying John Doe 1 through 1,000. And then what they do is they ask the court to issue subpoenas to the internet service providers, so like Charter or something like that. And then Charter, you know, hit with the subpoena, then supplies the account holder of the IP address.
But the holder, the person that's paying for it, is not necessarily the person that downloaded the stuff, because
that's the issue.
The technology has changed. So what have the courts been doing recently as the law starts to slowly catch up with the technology? What are they figuring out with these sort of these blind subpoenas?
Yeah, well, so like, you know, maybe 10 years ago, there wasn't, you know, most houses didn't have wireless routers where there could be the internet connections could be open and they could really be the IP address could be accessed by any number of people. It was all hardwired and there could be like one access or maybe two people accessing. But now with the wireless routers, it's so easy for people to have an open internet connection where people don't, we don't necessarily know who actually downloaded the movie. It could be somebody down the street.
You could get ripped off. They could be stealing your wireless service, right?
Exactly. So nobody knows who actually downloaded the movie. So some courts are saying, look, this is not enough. You can't just sue on the basis of a couple of IP addresses. It's not enough.
Shakedown artists, some of these guys, right?
They're trolls.
There you go. And you defend the honesty and integrity of the people that did not do it, right?
They claim they did not do it.
YourTrademarkAttorney.com, YourTrademarkAttorney.com, YourTrademarkAttorney.com. That's Morris Turek, his lovely girlfriend Karen. Thank you both for joining us. Have fun at Taco Bell tonight.
All right, great.
I hope you didn't ruin date night for you.
Not at all.
All right, there you go. Morris Turek, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, buddy. Anytime, you're welcome back.
Great.
There's hour one. I'm going to stop talking. This is the great Otis Redding. More Night Shift after news and spots right after this.